Good morning. I'm Peter Donalds in for Kathleen Dunn this week. A report issued by the International Committee of the Red Cross says that the suffering of civilians in Iraq is worsening. Our guests this hour will examine the struggling humanitarian efforts within Iraq, as well as the thousands of refugees who fled to neighboring countries. I said millions earlier, and I'll ask our guests about this, because we had a guest just earlier this week who put that number in the millions. It's partly about numbers, but it's more importantly about, as they say in their press releases, about putting a face and a voice to these numbers. So your calls and comments, welcome as always. 800-486-8655. That's toll free, of course, as we look at the humanitarian efforts of the Iraq story this hour. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, as I am, you can dial the local number, 414-227-2050. We'll be talking with Robert Carey, Vice President of Resettlement for International Rescue Committee, in our second segment, but we start with Simon Shorno. He's Washington Representative of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Simon Shorno, welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to have us on the show.
Why don't we just start simply and give us the gist of this report?
Sure. Well, yesterday the International Committee of the Red Cross issued this report on Iraq, and it's a report that paints a humanitarian situation in Iraq that is very difficult, and we express concerns in very strong terms, and we point to the suffering of the civilian population, the increasing suffering, and that's the reason for the report coming out yesterday, is that we see on the ground an increase in the violence aimed at civilians and then the effects of that violence on the life of Iraqi people. And we believe now is the time at a time when military considerations, political considerations are widely discussed, but the humanitarian angle is less discussed. Now is the time for an organization like ours to speak out.
And if you want to look at this report, you can go to icrc.org. That's correct, right?
Correct, yeah.
All right. Has the Red Cross been in Iraq since the beginning? We just passed our four-year anniversary. Were you there right from the outset?
Yeah, and well before then. In fact, the ICRC, the International Red Cross, has been in Iraq since 1980. So we have a long-standing presence, before this conflict, during the first Gulf War, during the war with Iran, in the aftermath of the first Gulf War, and from the onset of this current conflict.
And it's important to understand your history there, because I want you to give us an idea of the current trend. Your report says that humanitarian efforts and civilian troubles are worsening. Can you quantify that in a way for us? Compare it to past your past experience.
Well, we're not too keen on providing numbers, because those numbers shift, as you can imagine, and change. Certainly, we're talking about tens of thousands of people displaced. We're giving more precise number is over 220,000 people, mostly members of displaced family, have received food from our part. So that means that you can count in the tens of thousands of people actually displaced. But we're not too keen on giving precise numbers because of the evolving nature. What we see is an increase, and that's what we note, an increase in the violence, an increase in the displacement, an increase in the inability of medical facilities and medical structures to carry out their medical mission. And we express ourselves in those terms. We're a little wary about providing
sure.
In a context that's very difficult.
I understand. I was just looking for a comparison, a trend line,
mm-hmm.
and as you said, it's getting worse. So five primary issues are listed in the report. I'll go down them. Internal displacement, medical care, water and sanitation, the visitation of detainees by their families, and then missing persons.
Yep.
So let's just start at the top. Internal displacement, and also I'll add to that external displacement. Do we know, are there large numbers of people? There are large numbers of people who have left the country,
mm-hmm.
and they're displaced within the country. So what do these refugee camps look like?
Well, for the ICRC, we focus on internally displaced people, IDPs.
Okay.
Once people cross the border, they become refugees, legally speaking, and there our mandate stops. We, of course, have some programs in Jordan where we help, for example, the Jordan Red Crescent Society to provide some relief, but the bulk of our efforts are focused on internally displaced people, so people displaced within Iraq. And there, as you can imagine, that's one of the things our report underlined, is also the security situation and the degrading security situation and the impact that has not only for people, for Iraqi civilians, but also for ourselves. To be able to carry out our action. And so in order to, you know, for the ICRC to be involved on a daily basis with IDPs, the security situation is such that we have to work through local partners. And in Iraq, those local partners are the Iraqi Red Crescent, which is a sister organization to the International Red Cross. And they provide on a daily basis food relief to various camps around the country, mostly in the center of the country, but also in the south and around Kirkuk area.
And are you able, and along with the Red Crescent, to get these supplies to people? You mentioned security.
Yeah.
What's your success rate at getting help, or are you always under fire?
Well, it's a very difficult environment, and the ICRC has suffered some heavy losses in Iraq since the beginning of this conflict. We had, I think, six people killed, national staff, Iraqi staff, but also expatriate staff. Our delegation in Baghdad, our main office in Baghdad, was bombed in 2005. With loss of life, and so we had to curtail our operations there. Most of our staff, expatriate staff, is based in Amman, and then we have national staff in Iraq, and this national staff works very closely with the Iraqi Red Crescent. The Iraqi Red Crescent is pretty much the only organization in Iraq today that works across sectarian divides and throughout the country, in accordance with Red Cross, Red Crescent principles of impartiality, providing aid to victims regardless of their ethnic background or political background or gender.
I'm very curious to know what your relationship is like with local government officials, local militia leaders. Do you have to build and create relationships, sometimes even underground or behind the scenes relationships, in order to get your work done?
Sure, that's part of what we do. And again, Iraq is no different in a way than any context where the ICRC works. We work in conflict areas, and one of our duties, in fact, is to be in touch with all parties to a conflict. And so when we're in a conflict situation like Iraq, we are in constant dialogue with U.S. authorities, coalition authorities, Iraqi authorities, and the insurgency as well, because we need to ensure that the humanitarian mission of the Red Cross and of the Iraqi Red Crescent can be conducted. And it's essential for us to be in dialogue with all parties to the conflict to ensure our safety and that of our colleagues in Iraq, and also to make sure that all parties to the conflict understand their duty to abide to international humanitarian law, the law of war. And again, in our report, there is a strong statement about the value of international humanitarian law and the duty of all parties to the conflict to respect this body of law.
We're talking with Simon Shorno of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Later, we'll be joined by Robert Carey of the International Rescue Committee. Your call's welcome at 800-486-8655 as we discuss humanitarian efforts in Iraq today. 800-486-8655. We often hear, and sadly, it's become a political argument here in the States, but we do hear that there is progress being made, schools and hospitals being built. What can you say? Let's stick with the medical care side of things for a while. What can you say about the current state of medical care? Are Iraqi civilians getting what they need?
Well, two things. What we see is that hospitals, major hospitals and smaller clinics, local clinics, are overtaxed, overburdened. They don't have the supplies they need. They are under great strain because of the number of wounded people and sick people, but especially wounded people that come into the facilities, and they're understaffed. Many, many doctors and nurses have left Iraq. You were mentioning refugees a little earlier, and then many, many qualified doctors have left the country. So there's a shortage of staff, shortage of supply. Facilities are crumbling. Simple things like access to fuel, to have generators working, to have operating theaters working. You know, sometimes there's not even that kind of material support. So that's one thing. And the other thing is the safety aspect, where many people who are wounded or sick are terrified to actually go into hospitals and seek care, because hospitals have been targets of acts of violence. And so there you have those two elements, the security component and the lack of resources. And there, you know, we try and fairly extensively to support medical facilities in Iraq through blood banks, through various equipment, through generators, fuel, water, you name it. And again, this is done mostly through the Iraqi Red Crescent. But the ICRC certainly is very aware of those problems and tries to subside a little bit the effort.
And these military attacks on healthcare facilities and hospitals is part of your complaint about honoring international law.
Absolutely. Of course, medical staff and medical facilities are protected under international humanitarian law, under the law of war, and that's what we try to remind all parties to the conflict, that this is a must. It's not a choice. And again, the impact this has on the civilian population is just huge, and the right to medical care is just an essential right for a human being caught, especially caught in armed conflict.
Is this report, and again I'll mention it's Civilians Without Protection, The Ever-Worsening Humanitarian Crisis in Iraq. That's the report we're talking about, released from the International Committee of the Red Cross. You can find it at icrc.org. Is one of the, or maybe the purpose, goal of this report, I mentioned in the top of the hour that the newscasts we get on a daily basis, it's a car bomb here, a car bomb there. We just hear almost the same news every day, and as anyone knows, that becomes kind of numbing after a while. Is your effort to sort of kick us into consciousness?
In a way, yes. I mean, to put a human face definitely on the conflict, as I say, there is in this country lots of discussions in the media, in the public, in academia about the political aspects of this conflict, about the military aspects of the conflict. I hear very little about the humanitarian consequences of the conflict. So our report is certainly a way for us to put a face on those numbers that we see and that are numbing and that people perhaps start not paying attention after a while.
One account that I found very moving in your report was you asked an Iraqi civilian, if there's any one thing we could do for you right now, what do you need? And the answer was to please remove the dead bodies, our children don't have to see this on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think many of the quotes you see in the reports taken from discussions we had, again, with people in Iraq are absolutely a very telling, very strong statements that really go to show the depth of despair that civilians are confronted with. Again, we don't see those stories so much in mainstream media today, but that's the reality for many Iraqis, and that's one of our purposes, to bring that reality to people in this country and elsewhere.
What else are you asking for? What can a listener today do for you?
Well, the International Red Cross does not actually seek regularly money contribution, financial contributions from the public, because we're in fact financed by states party to the Geneva Conventions. Our report is not a call for public funding of our Iraq effort. What really we are asking is all parties to the conflict, and that involves the military as well as the insurgency, to respect the fundamentals of international humanitarian law and to make their utmost so that the civilian population has access to basic needs. And that's what we are trying to achieve. Now, your listeners certainly have an impact on the decisions that are made at the political level, at the local level, at the national level, and certainly we would hope that this somehow translates into action. But this is not the primary goal. Really, for us, it's a call to the authorities and to the public to continue to do their utmost for greater respect of IHL and human life.
Are there other agencies that you work alongside? Who else is in Iraq with you?
Well, very, very few agencies are present, and I haven't been in Iraq for a year, and I'm not quite sure who is actually active on the ground at this point. There's certainly some programs in place. The main humanitarian actors have still local staff in place. Very few expatriate, non-Iraqi staff still active, which automatically limits the kind of work that can be carried out by an organization. So that's also the problem, this shortage of humanitarian support for a situation, and that's linked, of course, to the security situation. Without security, humanitarians cannot carry out their work. And this is also a message that we try to pass on to anybody we talk to in Iraq.
What's your relationship with the U.S. forces and the coalition forces? What's that relationship like?
It's a relationship that is substantial. We've been speaking with United States authorities from the onset of the war and before, of course, but especially from an operational perspective since the beginning of the hostilities. So our contacts take place at different levels. We visit prisons. You mentioned detention as part of one of the issues discussed in the report, and detention is a big part of the work of the International Red Cross, and that means visiting prisoners held in coalition places of detention in relation to the conflict. So this work is carried out, and that work involves a dialogue that is confidential. We don't really discuss the nature of the dialogue publicly, but a very strong dialogue with the authorities on the ground and then also here in Washington. And this work takes place in Iraq, but also takes place in the framework of Guantanamo or Afghanistan as well. And so it's multifaceted, takes place at different levels. We're talking about humanitarian issues only. Detention is a big part of that discussion because there we want to be in constant dialogue in order to carry out our work, which is to assess conditions, monitor conditions, and then report to the detaining authorities so that, if necessary, steps are taken to ensure that international standards are respected at all times. So as you can imagine, this work precludes means a multitude of contacts at very different levels and contacts that are renewed on an everyday basis.
I certainly take you at your word that you're nonpartisan and you work across all lines, but I'll bet there's suspicion from others.
Well, you know, that's the case in Iraq, and it's the case in every single context where we operate. We are a neutral, independent organization, and we behave as such. We do not take sides into a conflict, and we maintain our neutrality at all times. Now, in any conflict where the International Red Cross is present, it is accused by one party or the other of taking sides and of not being neutral. So we make a particular effort in our discussion with authorities, and be it American authorities, coalition authorities, or other authorities in Iraq, to talk about humanitarian issues only in a way that's impartial, neutral, and shows our independence of action. That's the only way we can operate. That's the only way we can be accepted. So these criticisms, yes, they do surface with some regularity, but I think our action speaks for itself. The only reason we are able to be still in Iraq today and be able to operate in, I would like to point out, about 80 countries around the world, so pretty much every country where armed conflict is taking place today, is because we are neutral, independent, and our action is. And that's recognized, if not by sometimes politicians, it's certainly recognized by the people on the ground. Iraq is a particularly difficult place, and it's been very difficult, as I said, for us to operate in Iraq today. For example, the International Red Cross does not use its emblem because of the violence.
It would be a target.
Feel we could be targeted by using this emblem, and it's the only place in the world where we don't use the emblem, which for us is the only protection really that we have. We don't carry weapons. We go out in the field again without any protection, armed protection. We don't have weapons. The only protection we traditionally have had is our emblem. And in Iraq, after the bombing of our offices and the killing of our staff, we just feel that even that emblem has lost its protective value, yeah, which is very dramatic.
It is, and it's a horrible irony that the very emblem that protected you for all these years is now putting you in even greater danger.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm going to let you go. It's time to go to our other guest, Simon Shorno of Washington Representative International Committee of the Red Cross. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care. And after a quick break, we'll be talking with Robert Carey, Vice President of Resettlement for the International Rescue Committee. I'm Peter Donalds in for Kathleen Dunn. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Donalds here in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about a new report from the International Committee of the Red Cross entitled Civilians Without Protection, the Ever-Worsening Humanitarian Crisis in Iraq. I'll read just a short bit from that report. The humanitarian situation is steadily worsening, and it is affecting directly or indirectly all Iraqis. Protecting Iraqi's civilian population must be a priority, and the ICRC urgently calls for better respect for international humanitarian law. We thank our guest from the first segment, Simon Shorno of the International Committee, and next we go to Robert Carey. He's Vice President of Resettlement for the International Rescue Committee. Robert Carey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
What can you tell me from your end? The report is, let's talk pessimism versus optimism here. This is a dire report. The situation is worsening. What optimism can you give us at this time?
Regrettably, not much. I recently returned from a trip to Jordan as part of a team that was going to Jordan, Syria, and Turkey doing an assessment of humanitarian needs. And what we found at every turn was really a worsening and enormous scale humanitarian crisis. And there's, at this point, very little that has been done to address it.
We hope you'll join the conversation with our guest, Robert Carey of the International Rescue Committee. 800-486-8655, the toll-free number. Once again, 800-486-8655. The local number here in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. One of the elements of the report was to put a face and voice on these often anonymous reports that we get in the news. We talked with Simon Shorno about the daily news reports almost become routine, and this report from the Red Cross is looking to put a face and a voice on these numbers, right?
Yes, it is, and I think it does so very effectively, but I think that message needs to be continuously reinforced because, regrettably, you know, the humanitarian crisis and then the scale of it, as you described, is huge. You know, it's 4 million people, and even if those numbers are not exact, clearly it's enormous. 2 million displaced in Iraq, and upwards of 2 million who fled to adjacent countries. So it's one of the greatest humanitarian crises of our time, and it's growing every day. And the potential for the entire region to become destabilized is enormous. So it's on an individual level, it's horrific, and on a regional level, for the political implications are dire. And I know when but unfortunately, it doesn't have the photographic impact that sometimes compels people to respond. There aren't refugee camps. People aren't lined up in a way that can be captured on a newsreel. But you do find, if you go to Amman, Jordan, or Damascus, you know, in the back alleys and in crowded, poor neighborhoods, you see people who are living in horrific conditions and have been through hell to get there. They've witnessed violence against family members. There have been kidnappings. There have been, you know, virtually everyone I met with had a direct personal experience of pretty horrific violence, whether they'd witnessed the killing of a family member, the kidnapping sometimes of their children, rape. You can go down the list, and then it's detailed, and it's almost universal.
Well, now that goes against what we hear from some sides of the political debate, and as I said in our first segment, sadly, it's become a political debate here in this country. But often people will say, "Well, yes, there's violence, but it's isolated to certain areas of Baghdad, and much of the country is just living fine." Thank you very much.
Well, I can't speak to that, but I do know that among the refugee population, which is in the area of 2 million. If you talk to people, they've fled for a reason.
Right.
And they fled because there's been a direct threat to their well-being. So to some extent, that may be a self-selecting population, but it's an enormous one.
Now, what you said earlier about that there are no refugee camps per se, that I guess is a surprise to me. There aren't large congregations.
Well, the host countries really won't allow it. You know, neither part of it is legal, part of it is political. Neither Jordan nor Syria are signatories to the Refugee Convention, which delineates the rights of refugees. So officially, they don't refer to these populations as refugees. In Jordan, they're referred to as guests. And there's a real fear to acknowledging the scope of this problem could really have broad political implications for the stability of the Jordanian government. Neither Jordan or Syria are wealthy countries. And this is having an impact, on the prices are going up in Amman for apartments, for food, for clothing. They're not refugees or guests, as they're called, do not have access to public education, public medical care, or any other services. And I think there's a belief that to do so would really have an even greater effect and create more hardship for the local population.
So these neighboring countries really aren't providing services. That's left up to you and other aid agencies?
Yes, and the scope thus far is very, very limited. Syria does not really have a civil society. And I'd like to underscore, both Syria and Jordan have been enormously generous. They have allowed people to enter. They have not, Jordan has more recently effectively closed the border. I think part of the humanitarian imperative is to work with Jordan and Syria, provide them with aid so that they will allow people who are fleeing for their lives to cross and gain some degree of sanctuary, but keep those borders open. And I think that requires an international humanitarian response, that the international community and arguably the U.S. bear some responsibility for what has happened. And I think we believe at the International Rescue Committee that needs to translate into support for Jordan, Syria, Turkey as they host this enormous number of displaced people.
Let me ask you the same question I asked to Simon Shorno, and that is, who's your target audience for this report? And if part of that answer is the public, what are you asking of the public?
I think it's the Red Cross report, so I think they'd have to speak to their target audience. I think when we speak on this issue, it's a broad audience. We feel that this needs to be an issue that receives attention at the highest level of our government, both the administration and the legislative branches. And I believe that also that in the U.S., the American public needs to engage on this issue, or we'd like to see them engage, because I think there's a humanitarian tradition in this country of which is part of one of the proudest components of our heritage that has included support for people who are vulnerable and fleeing for their lives, and particularly when there is U.S. involvement. And many of the people who are fleeing are at risk or have been targeted because of their association with the U.S. military or contractors or even NGOs. So, there are many people, but religious minorities, in many instances Christians have been targeted. But translators, technicians, even people who did laundry have received death threats, been killed, and forced to flee for their lives. So there is a direct U.S. connection, and people who've associated themselves with U.S. policies and principles are suffering. And so I think, as has been the case in the past, Vietnam or elsewhere, we have an obligation, I believe, we have an obligation to provide some level of protection to those people.
Are you more or less free to Simon Shorno of the International Committee was very careful to remain nonpartisan, and he held to that pretty well. Are you in the same position, or are you able to speak more freely about the political situation?
Well, I think it's not a question of partisan. We are a humanitarian organization, so our our focus and our goal and our philosophy is to support humanitarian responses. So that's really what we see. So I think, you know, our role is not to attribute blame, but to really advocate for and be part of a response to address.
And I guess that's the reason I ask it. I understand the need for that focus on humanitarian, but it seems that people with your experience right there with the civilians and right there on the ground would have a really valuable vantage point, and you might be very tempted to lay some blame or some credit to those who deserve it.
Well, I think that's not our role. I think there are other organizations that engage in political analysis, and they're probably better equipped to do so.
Yeah. I certainly won't press you on it, but it seems you do have a particular vantage point there that others don't have. Let me ask you, going back to the refugees, you talked about the official response from the governments. How about in the neighborhoods from the natives of these countries? How are the refugees treated?
Well, in my experience, they were treated for the most part very warmly. You know, they've been allowed to exist, and there are whole neighborhoods that you would see in Amman, for instance, where people are living among the local population, and that has been, and in some instances are actually, I met with people who are receiving food and clothing and other assistance which allows them to live from the local population. But as I said earlier, these are poor countries. So the ability of the local population, particularly in these poor neighborhoods where most of the refugees are clustered, to provide support is limited, and I think that welcome can and is beginning to wear thin in many instances because it's having a negative impact on the local population as well. So I think they have been generous, but they've been generous without official support. You know, there's really not an infrastructure the way you would see in the U.S. to provide social services. So there are not many organizations out there providing food or clothing or housing to this refugee population. And people who did arrive with money, if they sold their house or car or had some savings when they fled, for the most part they spent those funds, so now they're living hand to mouth or really, you know, at risk. I talked to people whose children, and I saw children who were not getting medical care in Jordan. They can't go to a local hospital unless they can pay for it. They can't go to school. You know, there are children going hungry every day. It's just happening quietly and under the radar screen, unfortunately.
We're talking with Robert Carey. You've served as Vice President of the International Rescue Committee's Resettlement Department for the past 11 years. Is that correct?
Yes.
My information's up to date.
It is.
In your time, in your experience, how does this compare both, I guess currently this is the crisis on the globe?
It is. The largest one that we are seeing right now.
Okay.
You know, we try not to compare, but if you look at that, I mean, certainly Darfur is enormous as well.
Yes, of course.
But this is also, you know, has a regional impact that is huge in a heavily populated area.
And to put an historical perspective on this, how does it compare to other regions you've dealt with in your career?
Well, I think it's certainly on the, you know, I have to reach back to my memory of certainly on the scale of what we saw in Bosnia, if not larger in terms of displacement, or Cambodia. So it's you know, the scale cannot be, and it's growing. It's not reached an end. You know, the estimates right now are that 30,000 to 40,000 people are leaving per day. From Iraq, and an enormous numbers of people continue to be displaced internally, and the data on the situation both inside Iraq and outside is not good. You know, unemployment exceeding 50% in Iraq, over 50% of the population living on less than a dollar a day, an inflation rate over 70%, 75% of the children not attending school. So, I mean, you know, and you can go through, it's not good. And from a, if you look at that long term, the direction is it paints a pretty horrific picture.
And as the press picks up on this report, that is the headline most of the time. It's something about the fact that it's worsening or getting worse or ever worsening. Those are the words I'm seeing in the headlines. We're talking with Robert Carey. He's Vice President of Resettlement for International Rescue Committee. You can visit his website at theIRC, theirc.org. Your call's welcome at 800-486-8655. A quick break and then right back with your calls. Peter Donald's in for Kathleen Dunn talking about a new report from the International Committee of the Red Cross. Civilians Without Protection, the Ever-Worsening Humanitarian Crisis in Iraq. Our guest this segment, Robert Carey, Vice President of the Resettlement Vice President of the International Rescue Committee's Resettlement Department. Your calls, welcome, 800-486-8655. And Jeff is calling from Winneconne. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
The thing is that we shouldn't have been over there in the first place. We're just clearing it out for a dollar an hour people to work for corporate criminals. We need to get out immediately, okay?
Okay, Jeff, thanks for the call. Plain enough. I know you can't comment directly on that, but I bet you hear it a lot, right, Robert Carey?
I do, yes.
Okay, then I guess we'll just leave it at that.
Yes, I'm sorry, I don't have...
I certainly understand. Yeah. I certainly do. Let's go back to the list from the report, five primary issues. We talked with Simon Shorno about a little bit about displacement, a little bit about medical care. Can you tell us anything about the missing persons side of this story?
You know, I can't because it's not an area on which which we focus. But I think what I can say is that there's not a lot of data with regard to where people are. I certainly talk to people on an individual level. We interviewed refugees as part of our trip, and there were many people who told us stories of missing relatives, and that someone went out to the to the market, never returned, and that was a frequent story and theme that children who disappeared when they were playing, were seen on the street and then gone. Sometimes it was a ransom demand and they were not returned, and sometimes they were after the family sold or whatever they could and got some money together. But it was a consistent theme.
I'm certain in your work you travel quite a lot. Where are you as we speak?
I'm in New York.
Okay, and is that where you're based?
I am. Yes.
Okay, and you traveled most recently where and when?
Well, in February to Jordan, was part of a team that was going to Jordan, Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, and Turkey.
Okay. The reason I ask, I'm going to ask you a media question. We talked about it also in the first segment. Do you see your work or your concerns reflected in news reports? I started the hour by saying, really, we hear kind of these mind-numbing daily reports of bombings, but all the nuance and all the detail and the breadth of what you're talking about doesn't seem to be reported on a regular basis.
No, it's not, and I think that's one of our concerns. And certainly there's not been, though there's been a bit more recently, reporting on the refugee exodus. You know, and that's only come on the screen and to a limited extent and only quite recently. So, which is somewhat shocking when you consider the scope of it. You know, when you're talking about movements of multiple millions of people,
can you compare U.S. media to Middle East media?
Well, I certainly saw when I was in the Middle East, though I wasn't tracking the media in a formal way.
Right.
There was consistent coverage. I think Jordan. There's also a sensitivity, though. I think there's a concern that focusing on it too much could create instability. So I think there's both a focus on it, but also I think what I see in the U.S. media is there tends to be an enormous focus on what's happening in Baghdad. I suspect that's where a lot of the media is based, so that's why it tends to receive a lot of attention. Obviously, it's a horrific situation, and it deserves it. And I do think when people talk, or even when I talk in terms of hundreds of thousands or millions of people, that loses meaning. And it becomes hard to comprehend.
Yeah.
And when you get it down to the level of the and even when I meet with people and hear their stories, it resonates in a much different way. When you hear the person who was, who lost their two daughters, who were shot because they were doing laundry for American troops, and she shows you the pictures, or they go into someone's apartment in a back street, and there's no heat, there's no food, there's no bedding, and they have two children, age 5 and 7, who were kidnapped. And they sold everything they had to pay that ransom. And they were kidnapped because they were distantly associated with the U.S. Effort. So, was a technician. And those stories you hear consistently. And some of those people have close relatives in the United States, and you hear those stories consistently, that I have a father who lives in Detroit, I have an uncle who lives in Chicago, and they've been writing me, and and they're U.S. citizens. So there are many people with strong family links to the United States, and and I think that just creates it's a bit of a surprise sometimes when you're out there talking to people one-on-one.
Let's go to Afton, Minnesota, and talk with Sue Marie. Hi.
When you're out there talking.
Oh, Sue, you want to turn down your radio, please?
Go to Afton, Minnesota, and talk
with Sue Marie. Hello? Oh, no, I guess Sue Marie isn't there. I'll put you back on hold. Maybe she'll find us again.
Okay.
Jerry is calling from Waterford, though. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just concerned with some of the talk that we have. I know one of the earlier callers said that we should pull out immediately. If we did that, wouldn't that increase the refugee problem that we have there, and wouldn't that become the new killing fields if we precipitously just pulled out all our troops from Iraq?
Jerry, thanks for the question. I'm not sure if you want to comment on that. Robert?
I can't predict. It's a complicated thing. Obviously, an extraordinary, complicated situation. I think what we can see is people are moving now, and they're continuing to move. And I think they're what we need to push for. I believe is whatever the scenario is, whether it's a pullout or an increase, that there be a parallel humanitarian effort, because that's not happening. Whether it's in Jordan or in Iraq or elsewhere, that people who are displaced or are fleeing are protected and given allowed some degree of basic care and dignity.
Yeah. As part of your work, you're responding to the current situation, certainly. But do you, as Jerry is suggesting, do you look to the future? Do you put out possible scenarios and plan accordingly?
Oh, certainly. As a matter of fact, I was regrettably going through some papers that we prepared before the war started, and we drafted scenarios of detailing what might happen in the event of a war. And one of those that I drafted talked about a possible refugee outflow. Now, we put this more or less in a drawer and forgotten about it for a few years, but we estimated that there could be 700,000 people who fled. Now, obviously, that was, we underestimated. And that was our worst-case scenario 5 years ago. So we do try to predict and plan and plan our work accordingly. But
was that document shared with anyone, or was it an internal study?
It was an internal planning document. We did have discussions at the time. We were active in Iraq, both before the war and for a period of time afterwards, but pulled out because the threat to our staff was so great, and the security of staff couldn't be guaranteed.
Yeah.
We certainly looked at what are all the possible scenarios and what the implications might be, but we did not predict, even in our worst case scenario, anything that in any way remotely similar to what's happened.
Are you regularly asked to testify, whether here in the U.S. before Congress or other nations in front of their legislatures? Are you asked to testify and give information?
We certainly give information, and some of our staff do testify. We had staff members testify at a hearing about a week and a half ago. One of the members of the delegation who was with me testified in Washington.
And can you tell me anything about the response of that testimony?
Well, I think it's still pending. I think it was a hearing for informational purposes, and we gave a lot of information out about what we'd seen and the data we'd collected and what we saw the threats to be, and also what we recommended the response be. So I think that's going to be taken into account by people in the Congress as they work, hopefully, with the administration to formulate a response and hopefully inform that. And that's what we think that needs to be done. There used to be a regional response for some people who can't receive protection in the region. We think resettlement will be necessary, and we think that this action needs to be timely. You know, that we can't sit around, or people can't sit around for a year or months waiting for a response, because they're vulnerable and at risk now.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just think it's important for us that we, I believe, as a nation, have an obligation to alleviate suffering for which we are in some part responsible.
What's your next move or strategy? Is it a shifting strategy? Are you always implementing new scenarios and new plans, or is it much, as we said earlier, always kind of reacting to the?
No, I think we're both planning. We are if refugees are admitted to the U.S., we are planning to assist them, and the U.S. has announced that they will resettle 7,000 people in the next year. We think that's a positive step, but it's not nearly enough. We know that the number of people who are U.S. linked and are at risk now, and who've even translators and their families, is far, far in excess of that number. So we're urging that number be increased. So we're both advocating and planning programming. And then we have staff in the region who are continuing to set up programs, and they're constantly looking at what the needs are and how those are changing. And though at this point the need is so enormous, I think we won't pretend to be the only response. We're working with a lot of other organizations to try to do what we can.
Let's see if Sue Marie is back to her phone. Are you there, Sue?
Yes, I am.
Great.
You know, I'd like to know again how many are wounded and how many are dead. And then, don't we make any effort at all to just have a camp for them? I'm shocked. I never hear these figures over the news at all.
Well, we are hearing within Iraq that the average number of people killed per day is in excess of 100, and 200 to 500 are injured per day. It's interesting, 91% of the violent deaths are estimated to be men, so breadwinners. And most of those are 15 to 44. So, that has a lot of implications. We don't set up camps, and when refugee camps are set up, that has to be done with the permission of the government of the country in which the population is residing. And neither Syria, Jordan, or Turkey have allowed camps to be set up. So, if that's the most effective means, we would urge that be done. But the bottom line is there just needs to be support for people, whether it's in camps or in communities.
Yeah. Sue Marie asking again about numbers. And I guess numbers really are important to a lot of people. They want to put things in context, and I think maybe they might be important to policymakers too. There are certain numbers that they won't cross, or maybe I'm wrong about that. Do they really need to hear the kinds of anecdotal stories that you're telling?
I think they do, because I think the numbers, when you hear that there are 2 million Iraqi widows, I think that's certainly compelling and it's real. But when you hear the story of the individual and how, or you meet them, that this father of five children, and I'm, you know, was continuously threatened because he was a computer technician for the U.S. military, and then was killed. That his family is now living without any means to support the children, or, you know, that the children are not in school. I think, and you hear their names, and you see them, and you see that the child Omar has a severe ear infection and is not receiving medical attention, that they've been living on tomato soup for 3 days. I think that people at some level can identify with that in a way that they can't identify with the statistics.
Yeah. This is the first I've heard of the refugees coming to the United States. Is that signed and sealed? And when will that happen? And how will it happen? There certainly won't be a camp in the U.S. And just a few seconds left in the program.
Sure. The U.S. State Department announced that they would work with the U.N. to identify people for U.S. resettlement this year. Now, the mechanics of that are still being worked out, and we're hopeful that they will be. And obviously, for any refugee who enters the U.S., there's an extensive security review process. We're a little concerned that without some leadership at a high level in the government, the security process could drag on for so long that people may never move, and they may die where they are.
Well,
so
we've
seen very small numbers of people arrive thus far, I think under 100 last year. So,
okay.
You know, obviously that's not representing the need of even people who need to join immediate family here.
We'll have to watch that story. Thanks very much, Robert Carey, for joining us. He's Vice President Resettlement for the International Rescue Committee. In our first segment, we talked with Simon Shorno, Washington Representative of the International Committee of the Red Cross, about this report, Civilians Without Protection, the Ever-Worsening Humanitarian Crisis in Iraq. You can check it out at icrc.org. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produced the program, and John Treader for on-air production. I'm Peter Donalds.